We play more Bristol music than any other station.
We left the old world because it was barren, wasteland. There was nothing for us there. We came to the new world, and what do you see in front of the pyramid? Things beginning to sprout and grow. We have planted the seed of the great plan, the new world order, in the new world. And it is taking root, and it is growing.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The alleged mastermind of the 7/7 London bombings is quietly extradited to the US without a single question from politicians or the mainstream press. And Libya, 3 years since the lynch mob assassination of Colonel Gaddafi, did Britain and NATO destroy one of the most advanced and independent countries in the whole of Africa? And the secret government, or parallel government, a Swiss academic says he's discovered how it all works. He explains what he's proved about the far-right secret committees, made up of people the public had never heard of, which governed one European country from behind closed doors. Also, Die Dollar Die, one former bank employee, has written a book all about how obsession with the dollar is killing economies and wages all around the world. We hope to talk to Robert Salisbury, he's a young banking analyst dealing in property, and we take his view on human rights, bank corruption and tax havens. And Robert, I hope, is joining me from Australia on the line now. Hi, Robert. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, I realise it's a bit early in the morning there, Robert, so thanks very much for taking the trouble to give us a call. Just tell us, first of all, a little bit about your background.
OK, I was born in Birmingham, so I am a Brit, and so it's very nice to be talking to people in Bristol and the wider audience. I've been in Australia for about 10 years. My background, to do with this book anyway, started with working as an licensed equity dealer in London, back in the late 90s, and it was my introduction to finance, and I studied bonds and equities, etc. And what I believed as I went into that job was that the banking industry and the City of London was the establishment, and that because they are so influential and important, they must be doing something right. But I think after many, many years there, I formed a very different opinion of them and of their morals and how they work and how they behave. And that can be summed up in a phrase that states that the City of London is a big casino. And I think that's really more or less what it is. But it goes deeper than that. And it goes to what we're seeing at the moment over the last 10 years, I suppose, because of the internet, is this release of information upon the world, and it's transforming the way we look at society, and it's also highlighting some of the inadequacies of democracy. So we are, certainly in the West anyway, we are looking at the world as it is, and we are seeing that it can be a lot better. Last night I actually had a meeting with a number of people here in Sydney, Australia, who amongst them range from people from banking families, a CFO of a company, a psychologist, somebody who works for the government in international trade, and all of us, and another chap actually who comes originally from Serbia, and there's a lot of Serbians in Australia, and who has first-hand experience of the atrocities that happened there when the Muslims and the Christians clashed. Basically, all of us believe that democracy as it now stands is probably not what we thought it was, and that we have been sold a story, and that really we deserve better. And I think there is a lot of anger in society in the West. We have our own problems in the richer world, and they need to be dealt with. And I think that the conspiracy theory, as people keep talking about it, probably undermines the reality of how serious the problem is. And I think also that the exciting side of this and the positive corollary of what's going on at the moment is that we are probably seeing the emergence, or we are going to see the emergence of something very new. A new dynamic is possibly likely to emerge. And my book, Die, Dollar, Die, the subtitle is Fall of the American Colossus. And it's hinting that as the American empire falls and wanes and reaches its sort of September years, which is really where we are, we're probably going to see a new dynamic in the world. And I don't really want to talk about New World Order. I don't want to term it the New World Order, because what I am a little bit concerned about is that a lot of the things that are actually happening are being categorized very early on, as we are. And this is probably not giving a chance for the reality to be seen.
Now, hang on a second, Robert, because one of the things you said just there, I have to take issue with, really, and that is that the city is a casino. I mean, even a casino has rules and laws, and the city is surely governed like that.
No, they do. They have rules and laws. And look, there's nothing wrong with having rules and laws, and they do have them. They don't always follow them. And those rules and laws don't always work. And I'll give you a classic example of that, which will illustrate one of the problems. The banking sector has a system of rating finance, and we've all heard about this on the news and the TV. We say they are AAA or they are AB, and we get a ranking, if you like.
People like Moody's, yeah.
Yeah, like, you've got Moody's, you've got Fitch, you've got a number of people that actually their job is to analyse assets, banks, countries, financial institutions, and give them a rating. It's a kind of a tick, a double tick, an ABC, a bit like your school report. Now, in the GFC, one of the issues was the selling of assets that had been packaged. And these packaged assets, which were toxic, let's say, were actually rated AA. So all of the systems that we have in place in the US and the UK that are there really to give a kind of a monitoring of our school report on finance, if you like, was saying that this packaged asset is actually an AA. So it's reliable, it's low risk, you can invest in this safely because the risk is low. And that was then sold out all over the world and to the more, let's say, naive banks of the world and the more naive investment firms. They bought these assets from the Americans and from the Brits and all the bankers that were selling them. And of course, they ended up with egg on their face because these were no good. These were not AAA products.
So was that deliberate? Sorry, Robert, I'm going to interrupt you again. Was that fraud or a mistake?
I think it shows the inadequacy of the system. If you're self-regulated and if you trust what they do, you're misunderstanding what's going on. When I say it's a casino, I mean it's a bit of a free-for-all, and the people in the system know that. And the game really is, how do you outdo your opponents, knowing that they are in the casino with you and that the rules are there, but they're not necessarily to be followed.
Okay, so it sounds to me what you're saying is that, yes, there are rules in the casino, but some people are twisting them, bending them. I mean, we've also had one of the main reasons for this financial crisis back in 2008 was the accountancy firms, that is to say the people, the auditors, the people that check the books of all the banks. And it sounds very similar to the ratings agencies. What they're doing is they're going ticking off the banks saying, this is fine, this bank's absolutely fine, the debts are going to be paid, etc. When actually they're not. So do you think this is a sort of systemic problem? And because the thing... Of course, if you're paying for someone to audit your bank, or if you're paying to get ratings from Fitch or Moody's, you want them to give you a good result, don't you?
You do. I think what you have to do, I mean, I've been looking at this for a long time, spoke to a lot of people, and I know you have put a lot of time and effort into this, and I must admit, your website, bilderberg.com, which is where I...
It's dot org, actually. That's, sorry, that may org. Be them, bilderberg.com.
Org, get it right. That's where I originally found out about you, from the other side of the world. So people are looking into this situation all over the globe. Now, one statement that's written on the back of Die, Dollar, Die is a quote by one of the main characters in the book. And I think we can analyse problems in every single industry, and everybody listening to this now will be working within a company. Now, it's not just about the bank, the City of London or New York. It's actually about maybe the health system or the education system. There is a kind of corruption in everything. And we sometimes believe that rules, ethics, and systems are absolute. Now to show that they're wrong, there is one statement on the back of the book, Die, Dollar, Die, and it's by Henry Delange, and he represents a large fictional bank called Delange Martin. And he makes a statement to the protagonist, the hero in the book, whose name is Philip. And he is an older, middle-aged man who's been in the banking system a long time. And Philip, the young character in the book, is a young man. He's 29 years old. And he says to him, "Nothing happens by chance, Philip. Everything is arranged." And in that statement, he is hinting to Philip that what you see on the surface is not reality. You are seeing something that is constructed. And all the rules, if we want to look at the rules for a moment, Fitch and all that sort of thing, that's the face that's thrown up to you. A bit like democracy, like voting, like all these things that we look at and we criticize and we get obsessed with them. We go, oh, that's wrong. We need to change that. We don't need to change it. We need to wipe it away. We need to see where reality is. What he is suggesting to young Philip in that statement, nothing happens by chance, everything is arranged. He's saying, well, we've arranged things, and the arrangement is that there is this edifice that people are fed. I had a bit of an epiphany. I'm 50 now. I hadn't been an epiphany about 5 years ago, and I'm not a religious man. I don't believe in God. But I feel that there is something spiritual that at the answer to all of these issues. And a friend of mine, he actually meditates, and he's a very calm guy. He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, doesn't blaspheme, and he writes songs. He's a bit of an artist over here in Australia, and I'm very proud that he actually is writing a song based on this particular line. But one thing he said, he was saying that, and he's done many years studying all of this, and he is also into the Chinese situation that's going on over there, because they have their own issues with them, with the Muslim thing that's going on in the Western world. They have a little bit of this going on in Western China. But he said spirituality could be the key, because think of it this way. When you're looking at do we go to war, is the City of London corrupt, whatever the conspiracy might be, if you base your premise on, well, let's analyze the laws and the rules and see where it goes wrong, you're already into murky water, because you're analyzing something that is an edifice. It's been arranged. It's been arranged by who? Okay. Oh, the people who are behind the scenes. Well, first of all, you're on shaky ground. But if you go a spiritual route, you say this. You say, first of all, my bedrock will be honesty, it will be integrity, and I'll start from that position, and then I'll work up from there. So you look at everything, and once you smell that it's wrong, then you know where you stand. You know, well, hold on, I don't need to fully understand everything. I know it's wrong. And isn't it strange that over the years, certain people, certainly religious people as well, often say things like, well, money is the root of all evil. And I know these things can be seen very crass at times, but there's a certain wisdom in some of the more common phrases that we hear throughout life.
Now, Australia is a big part, Robert, of the war on terror. It seems to be actually getting more enthusiastic, at least the Australian government is, about joining the US and NATO in this war on terror. What are your thoughts about the origins of that and where it's heading?
In Australia?
Well, I mean, globally, really, from an Australian point of view.
Well, look, I mean, my view on the war on terror and the vilification and this... I mean, look, things have happened. We saw yesterday this terrible situation in Canada. Nobody can ever condone or not condemn when a lone person goes out and shoots somebody. But there have been hundreds of thousands of people killed in the Middle East. And it is incredible that there isn't more anger in the West by people with a disaffected point of view, based on what is happening in the Middle East. It is shocking that there isn't more going on. I mean, Australia is a very peaceful place. I have to say, I've been here 10 years. There isn't very, very little violence, even in pubs. You know, I mean, you just don't see violence in Australia the way you see it, say, in the UK. But Australians are a little bit, no, I wouldn't say paranoid, but they are very wary of foreigners, if you like, because Australia is a little bastion of peace. An economic, it's very benign in a way.
Well, what are your thoughts? I want to pin you down, Robert, I want to try and pin you down on your thoughts about how the financial crisis, the financial crimes you're talking about, relate to the war on terror. I mean, it's a bit of an old-fashioned phrase. It's not used so much nowadays. But, you know, because
the... In my opinion, the war on terror is an edifice. It is... Let's go back to the statement. Actually, there's another statement in the book which relates to that. Sapel, who is another one of the more senior people in the book, he says, it is not a crime to kill someone you don't know. So that's a statement he makes in the book, and he makes this to Philip, the character. He says, it's not a crime to kill someone you don't know. And the heartlessness of that particular statement is at the very center of some of the decisions that the people who are controlling the main money supply of the world have when they make decisions, the ramifications of which are that we end up killing people. So the war on terror, in my opinion, is not a genuine issue. It is a manufactured issue whose purpose is to have an effect on the populace.
Finally, Robert, die, dollar, die. Why is it? It always sounds like it's just a cry also coming from your heart. It's not just the name of the book. Do you think that it would be the sooner the dollar stops being the world's reserve currency, the better?
I wouldn't pass judgment on whether it's good or bad. And the invective in the double use of the word die shows that it's a kind of a... It's a bitterness, isn't it? Die, dollar, die. It sounds malicious. But the reason why I made that the actual title is because if you look at what's happened over the last 20 years and you look at all the big issues, I would hasten that if you studied enough of them, you will find the root of most of them go back to the fact that America is declining and that their power is derived from the fact that they control the global currency of the world. Just as the British Empire was controlled when Britain controlled trade of the globe all over the world. I mean, we know as British people, and there was a wonderful speech in Parliament by an elderly gentleman who must have been 90, and he was from Leeds, I think, or somewhere like that. And it was Bradford, and he was saying how the conditions that he grew up in, which were appalling. It was poverty beyond our wildest imagination. People didn't have healthcare before the NHS. So even though Britain was ruled the waves and all this sort of thing, had an empire 100 years ago, the reality is, for a lot of British people, quality of life wasn't very good. But we had the control, and the people who were using that control and benefiting from it weren't necessarily the British, the everyday British people. They were a handful of people who had access and control over money. And the same is true of America. We all know by looking at the news, watching television, we can see that a lot of America is a lawless, a pretty wild place that by terms in Western Europe might be seen as almost uncivilized.
Okay, so Robert, whereabouts, can I just cut you short there, please? Because whereabouts can people get hold of your book?
Okay, the book, it is basically, you have to go to, if you go diedollardie.com, you will see how you can get a copy of the book.
Is it available as an e-book or as a paper book or what?
You can get it as a paper book, and I get requests from all sorts of strange places. Actually, just recently one from Canada, which is very warm, warming to my heart considering what's going on over there. Diedollardie.com, you can go there, or robertsalisbury.com will lead you eventually to where you can get hold of the book. And it is one of three books. This is the first one. I'm working on the second one, which is called The Shadows. And the shadows are the people behind the scenes. They
okay.
are the people.
Robert Salisbury, calling from Salisbury, 4 o'clock in the morning. Fantastic. Thank you very much for staying up so late or getting up so early. Very much appreciate it. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
getting bigger by being better.
The number one choice for Bristol.
This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, interesting hearing from Robert there, someone who's actually real experience in the city, writing sort of from a personal point of view, a fictional account of the sorts of things that go on within the city. But ultimately, he's right, isn't he? The dollar is dying. And in fact, we've heard this week that that there's a real moves now, particularly in Moscow, also in Beijing, to start de-dollarizing. Actually, a lot of these big power blocks around the world are saying, well, actually, we are going to start ditching dollars.
Yes, and it is going to happen, but the problem is that it may be an extremely violent process. When you get changeovers in the international system like this, they don't necessarily happen in a smooth way. And in actual fact, the US is using its military muscle all over the world in order to try and prevent the rather natural death of the dollar as the world reserve currency. And that, of course, is incredibly dangerous for humanity, because the potential is that the whole thing just tips over into world war, as it has
done
in previous occasions.
Look, I don't understand that. Surely there could be a fairly sensible transition from the dollar being used less, and other currencies like the yen, and also the euro and the ruble being used more. Well, it doesn't have to be a catastrophic change.
Well, it doesn't, but then the Americans would have to gracefully accept not being top nation anymore and allow other people to take over that role. You'd have thought we're only a tiny speck of dust in the middle of nowhere in universal terms, that might be a sensible solution. But unfortunately, the kind of habits of the past die hard. It's what Karl Marx said, the traditions of all the dead generations weigh like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And the people who are running the United States are basically not willing to cede power and to accept a multipolar world. Sergei Glazyev, who's Putin's economic advisor, has been pointing all these things out. He's a very smart guy. And the real problem is that they're trying to provoke war in order to try and prevent the dollar from being the world's reserve currency being undermined. So, of course, the conflict in the Ukraine, which actually makes the Western Europeans more dependent on the Americans and breaks their links with the Russians, is part of this strategy. But, of course, it's actually disastrous for the economy of the Europeans, and ultimately possibly going to lead to war.
Well, back in July, it was the BRICS countries over in Brazil created basically a competitor to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. We've heard just a couple of weeks ago from Press TV, that is the Iranian English language broadcaster, de-dollarization. Iran and Russia are also planning to establish a joint bank. It just seems that this is a sensible thing to do, surely. If you can see that a currency isn't going to do too well in the future, you need to be prepared.
Well, the fact is that the dollar is losing its reserve currency status because they've abused that reserve currency status. The dollar used to be linked to gold until 1973, when the dollar was famously taken off the gold by Nixon because he wanted to fight the Vietnam War. They were losing the Vietnam War, and what they should have done is just thrown in the towel and said, we're losing, we're not going to take the dollar off gold, we'll just have to pack in. They didn't want to do that, so they took the dollar off gold and set the whole thing in motion that we're now living in, where the dollar isn't connected to anything at all. And of course, what that means effectively is that the US can print money, which other people accept, and they get a tribute from the rest of the world to allow them to carry on having the biggest military in the world, etc. But of course, this is ultimately an imperialistic policy against the interests of the rest of humanity, and it will, directly or indirectly, lead to war. It is doing so.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, it's 3 years since the lynch mob assassinated Colonel Gaddafi. Questions still also about what role Britain and NATO and Western countries actually played in showing the militias whereabouts Gaddafi was. I'm using satellites and other devices to follow him and then explain to the local militias, local fighters, whereabouts they could find Gaddafi. But has the most advanced and independent country in the whole of Africa been destroyed? What are your thoughts initially about the question in Libya, because things aren't looking too good there at the moment?
No, they're not, and of course we're not being told very much about it, because it's rather embarrassing for those who push the agenda that they push. Incidentally, linked
who was that, by the way?
Well, just let me say, incidentally, the Libyan gold dinar was being developed, which would have allowed people to buy oil for Libyan gold dinars, because the Libyans had massive gold reserves and oil reserves, and they were going to create a currency for Africa, which wasn't the dollar. And some analysts suggest that that is the reason why Gaddafi had to be removed. It's also become clear, with hindsight, that the plan to remove him was in advance of the uprisings in Benghazi. Something called Operation Southern Mistral 2011 was a plan by the British Air Force and the French Air Force, a war game to protect demonstrators in a country which was designated as the south of France. There would be a UN resolution to put in a no-fly zone, and then the British and the French Air Forces would enforce that no-fly zone, and then glory be, just as they were about to carry out this war game, which they'd planned for several years before, then exactly that scenario played out in Libya, and the British and French Air Forces were used in the way that was suggested, which means that the whole thing was planned. It wasn't a series of random events.
We're just hearing today in the Telegraph, just literally an hour or so ago online, Libya has become the latest ISIS conquest. Extremists have declared Libya is part of the caliphate. That's in the Telegraph. Libya is now in the throes of an extreme political crisis, they say. If the conditions remain unchallenged and hence unchanged, it will turn into another Syria or Iraq. While ISIS has managed to capture the attention of the international media with its powerful propaganda and violence attack, the world has ignored the equally threatening Islamist groups and movements that have prospered in North Africa in the post-Arab Spring vacuum. Nowhere is this threat more profound than the rise of radical Islam in Libya. Now, also, apparently, the parliament is so insecure in Libya that's been installed by the West, even though it's making attempts to be democratic, it can't even meet on the mainland. They have to go and meet on a ship off in the Mediterranean Sea.
The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who were the spearhead of the attack on the Gaddafi regime, have a link to the British intelligence services going back decades. So, for example, David Shaler and Annie Machon left MI5 over links with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and attempts to assassinate Gaddafi in the 1990s. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is the Al-Qaeda Libya, and one of their leaders, Abdul Hakim Belhaj, I've just seen a photograph of the internet today of him meeting with John McCain, the US president, former US presidential candidate. The way this works is that the Western intelligence services in Syria, Libya and elsewhere basically arm, train, direct and encourage Islamist terrorists, and then they say, oh, we're going to have to invade Libya, Syria, strike out, which whatever country we're talking about, in order to restore order. So in other words, this may actually all be part of the plan. Libya descends into chaos, and eventually we will have to go in there to restore order. But of course, the linkages between the Western intelligence services and the most extreme Islamist groups, I'm afraid, has been going on for so long now that the evidence that they are linked together is overwhelming. And we're going to talk in a little while about Harun Ashwat. But the point is that most listeners to this show will be aware that these linkages are basically proven. There's no real doubt about it. MI6 and the CIA have intimate linkages with all of these far extreme Islamist groups.
So why are we here?
Going back decades.
Why aren't we hearing about this on Panorama and in the mainstream press?
Because the mainstream press are part of the psychological warfare operation, so they're there to tell people a story that the mainstream press should have reported that Operation Southern Mistral was planned in advance before Libya was bombed. And of course, up to, nobody's quite sure, but it's been between 20,000 and 30,000 people were killed by NATO bombings of Libya. Those were mostly civilians.
It was supposed to be a no-fly zone.
Well, yes.
It's a bit of mission creep.
Yes, but the no-fly zone was written into the plan for Operation Southern Mistral 2011, and including the UN agreeing to the no-fly zone. Now, the Chinese and the Russians agreed on the Security Council to a no-fly zone in Libya, because they presumed it would be similar to the no-fly zone over Bosnia when I used to work over there, which would basically just stop the Libyans using aircraft. But, of course, it then became a mechanism for them to give close air support to al-Qaeda. So both in Syria and Libya, the Royal Air Force has actually acted as al-Qaeda's air support. And that's just a fact. That's just what's been going on.
Very strange,
isn't it? All those chaps with the blue uniforms are al-Qaeda's air support.
So we've had in and around Syria, we've had the Turkish Air Force actually bombing the Kurds, and yet the RAF actually supporting the supporting the Kurds by bombing ISIS, supposedly. I mean, this seems like a bizarre situation. If you've got they've got the Kurds fighting ISIS, you've got the Turks fighting the Kurds. Surely, you know, there might be clashes in the air between Turkish jets and RAF jets.
No, because we're talking about different Kurdish groups. But the point is, the take home for ordinary people listening to this is it's far more complicated than you're being told, and that the West is largely responsible for the mess. I'll repeat it again. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, has been on television in France, and he said quite clearly that before the Arab Spring, he was approached at an international meeting by British officials. He stressed they were British, not the US, and they said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?" So we have prima facie evidence that the British government, led by David Cameron, began the war in Syria, which has killed hundreds of thousands and displaced millions. Not Bashar Assad, David Cameron. David Cameron to The Hague? Electric chair? Lethal injection? What do our listeners think?
Well, maybe just a while in jail. But anyway, we're going to hear now from Dave Roberts. Dave Roberts is a filmmaker. He's part of an organisation called Global Civilians for Peace in Libya. They've got a WordPress blog, globalciviliansforpeace.wordpress.com. And I interviewed him a couple of months ago, actually, about Libya, and asked him how the democratic system works over there. Because I'm as fascinated to hear, you know, I heard a lot of rumours about Gaddafi is a dictator, he took over, dictator, but actually apparently a lot of decisions were farmed out. In other words, he had a system whereby actually he couldn't do what he wanted because it had to go through a democratic process. So let's hear from Dave now about the kind of brand of democracy that Gaddafi had brought in Libya.
Dave Roberts, I was one of the leaders of the Global Civilians for Peace in Libya, which was an organization that came together very quickly when the threat to Libyan sovereignty occurred in the first few months of 2011. It had some of the highest incomes, all the welfare indices, you know, World Health statistics. Libya was the jewel in the crown. In fact, was better placed than some of the countries of Southern Europe in terms of the social indices, in terms of certainly education. I mean, there was free universal education to PhD, all the way up to PhD level. Women were encouraged to be involved in all aspects of public life. As you say, the low mortality rate, it was the highest in the whole of Africa. In fact, in January, before the war broke out, before the intervention was being organized in February, the United Nations was about to award Gaddafi and Libya a human rights award for the development of education and welfare services in Africa. He was being held up as, you know, as you say, the jewel in the crown of African development. I certainly had, you know, personal and practical experience, both professionally and you know, politically, when I've been in Libya, of the incredible developments. And if you have to think that, you know, in 1969, when Gaddafi came to power in a bloodless coup, you know, the country was the most backward area of North Africa. And to achieve what they achieved within the 40 years, and to actually bring together all the factions that we've seen now, that have all been stirred up again with all their petty hatreds, to bring all those people together for 40 years. And it wasn't done, you know, by dictatorial rule. It was done by the development of people's councils, which enfranchised everybody. In the sense that everybody could be involved in the political process. Anyone over 16 could join the local people's committee, where resources and policies, resources were distributed, policies were being developed, and, you know, take part in the political process on a day-by-day and weekly basis. It was a different form of government democracy, from the West. And why the West, you know, should think that Gaddafi or the Libyan people should adopt their particular form of democracy over an indigenous developed form is another question, of course.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that, because it seems to me maybe perhaps we in the West could learn something from this form of democracy that Gaddafi had developed in Libya. How did it work? And I wonder if you can point us towards any references by people can find out more about this.
Well, he's written most of it down in his green book, which is actually badly translated and is often, you know, poo-pooed by Western economists and Western theorists, economic theorists. But in terms of, it certainly worked for 40-odd years and worked very well for the Libyan people. It's called a direct democracy. It challenges the notion that democracy, the Western form of democracy, i.e. that, you know, we every 4 or 5 years are given the privilege of going into a cloaked room and putting a cross against a name, and that is the sum total of your democratic choice for the next 5 years. It actually engages people and organizes them in people's committees, so everybody, wherever they lived in Libya, was entitled to attend their people's committee. Their people's committee would meet once a week. Those committees would be replicated at local level, regional level, all the way up to national level. It was a participatory form of democracy, often where officials were appointed by local people and were instantly recallable by local people and accountable to local people on a weekly, monthly, quarterly basis. So there was no idea that you just put a cross on a piece of paper and that's the end of the democratic process for you. You can be engaged, you can be debating, discussing, deciding issues at a local level, or a regional level, or a national level. And I've certainly been in some of those unwitnessed with other academics from the UK, the workings of those people's committees. And they were certainly very different. There would be 2,500 people in a theatre who literally just walked in off the streets to hold the public officials to account, to explain, you know, why things hadn't been done or had failed to be done within certain times, and to discuss a whole set of policies, whether that's about, you know, education, welfare, or pensions, or anything else. And of course, one of the greatest things was that they nationalized property, and everybody was entitled under the constitution to a house, and that every Libyan had to be housed, and every, you know, and no one could have more than one, interesting enough.
What's the situation over in Libya now, Dave?
Well, interesting enough, I've just come off the phone an hour ago with a friend who's there at the moment, and is trying to get back. It's chaos. I mean, you've now got, according to the local paper, you've now got two prime ministers with as rival factions are vying to, jockey for recognition as the legitimate government of Libya. One faction has already put out a statement asking for Western intervention in order to be able to protect state assets, because it cannot guarantee the security of its oil fields, of its public buildings, of its highways, of its airports, from rival militia gangs, many of them jihadist gangs, who are literally vying for power and setting up their own individual fiefdoms across the whole of Libya. And of course, you've got this farce where the government has been, the parliament has been housed in a ship offshore for the last several months because it's unsafe for them to actually operate on the land in Libya. Western policy may have been to wreck that country rather than bring some sort of functioning democracy to it.
I think that's probably right. They certainly did. They certainly have wrecked it, whether they intended to or not. And I don't suppose that Libya was an entirely free place under Gaddafi, but it was certainly in better nick than it is now. And maybe, you see, what's happened in Syria is that Assad has managed to survive, and that's what I thought would happen in Libya, that, you know, there'll be some kind of attempt to broker a ceasefire, some kind of political transition. But the West decided to go for broke. They cheered when Gaddafi was assassinated, as Hillary Clinton famously did. And, of course, there's no legal basis for assassinating the heads of state of other countries.
I mean, there were moral case was made, certainly in the mainstream media here, over Libya's involvement in the Lockerbie bombing and also the murder of the policewoman, PC Yvonne Fletcher.
Yes, well, in both of those cases, in actual fact, it's quite likely that the Libyans weren't directly involved, certainly in Lockerbie. The reason why Megrahi had to be released by the Scottish government was because a Scottish police inspector was going to testify at his appeal that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene, to wit, planting a circuit board on the crime scene, supposedly from a bomb from Libya. Although, if you think about it for 2 seconds, that's obviously rubbish. There would be no circuit board from a bomb. Okay, a bomb also, would go off and there would be no circuit board.
A dispatch is a two-part dispatch. Yes. Running over 2 weeks, was done on the death of PC Yvonne Fletcher, where they proved beyond any doubt, at least according to British Army's ballistics expert, that it's absolutely impossible for Yvonne Fletcher to have actually been shot from the embassy.
She was probably assassinated by the Western intelligence services to make the Libyans look bad. Now, some people may go, poo-poo, we don't believe things like that. I'm afraid that's the real world we live in. That is the real world we live in. The Western intelligence service has been working particularly with Islamist groups for the last 30 years, particularly the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And, they are our allies.
OK, as we speak, there's a lot of stuff going around the world, news-wise, about the possibility that ISIS has actually become very well organised in Libya, is starting to push out some of the more moderate Islamist groups that are fighting there. But the US and European allies are calling to an end to violence. Now, what's going on here?
What's going on here is a various levels at which these things operate. The Libya, the creation of chaos is part of Western geopolitical strategy. So that these Islamist groups are encouraged and protected. Libyan Islamic Fighting Group being a classic case. And then, of course, when you've got chaos, you can then move your geopolitical pieces around. You can get access to oil. The Chinese, for example, were driven out of Libya. They had 30,000 people working in the oil industry in Libya, Chinese National Oil Corporation, all removed. The oil now is not in the hands of the Chinese. You say, well they've made a mess of this, because if they wanted the oil from Libya, they're not getting it. The place is such chaos, there's no oil coming out. But I tell you what, who isn't getting the oil? The Chinese aren't getting it, and that was the point.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Next topic is the secret government, a parallel government. A Swiss academic called Daniela Ganser says he's discovered how it all works. He explains what he's proved about the far-right secret committees, made up of people the public has never heard of, which govern one European country from behind the closed doors. And he's talking about Italy.
People like Lizio Gelli, I looked at these people in more detail. Lizio Gelli was obviously a right-wing extremist in the Italian Cold War, and he was convinced that the Cold War was a war. You know, he didn't consider it to be peacetime. He thought we are at war with the Italian communists. And so he was actually paid a lot of money by the United States to make sure that the influence of the Italian right-wing groups were strong in Italy. And Gelli made this statement that, you know, thanks to Gladio, Italy didn't become a zone of communist influence. So he was proud, and he said, we had a lot of influence behind the scenes. Obviously, in public, people would say Italy is a sovereign country and is a democratic country. But he says, that was not true. We were neither democratic nor sovereign, because we had a parallel structure, in this case, the Propaganda Due, which was a network of people who were from the parliament, who were from the executive, who were leading industrialists, who were bankers, and who also were judges or police officers or military officers. And they all cooperated behind the scenes. And that is not the idea of democratic checks and balances. In a democracy, you actually have the parliament which controls the executive. Okay? And if something goes wrong, you have the judge who says, you know, it's not all right. But in Italy, with the Propaganda Due and with Gladio, we had parallel structures who operated behind the lines. And Lizio Gelli was always invited to United States when a new president came into office, such when in 1981 Ronald Reagan became the new president of the United States. Lizio Gelli was there. He was invited because he was an important person from the globe. And the same in Germany. If you look at Reinhard Gehlen, whom you mentioned, he was a general who worked for Hitler during the Second World War. And many people think that at the end of the Second World War, all the generals who worked for Hitler went to the Nuremberg trials. You know, they went directly to jail. And that's not true. Some did, but others were flown to Washington because they were useful. Okay, the Counterintelligence Corps, which is an American secret service, they recruited some of the Nazis and said, now, why don't you run secret operations for us in Germany? You are useful. And Reinhard Gehlen, he was the chief of Fremde Heere Ost, he was then the first commander of the first German secret service, which was called Organisation Gehlen. That's quite embarrassing, you know, that actually a general from Hitler was the first commander of the first German secret service. But under these circumstances, the stay behind armies and the secret structures could be set up also in Germany. When I say Germany, I mean obviously the part controlled by Washington and not the part controlled by Moscow.
Well, he's talking about East Germany there, obviously. That's Daniela Ganser, a Swiss academic, the author of NATO's Secret Armies. Now, Martin, there seems to have been, at the end of World War II and since then, a real fear of communism, largely because, nothing to do with a political ideology particularly, but because communists started nationalising things and they were taking big industries off of the hands of people who'd had them for many generations.
Well, yes, there was the anti-communism is not just anti-communism, it's anti-progressive. Progressive politics toot court. I mean, the Italian Communist Party were a democratic party. They repudiated Stalinism, and that's what made them popular, because they were Italians, they were well dug into the communities, particularly in the north of Italy, but it was not acceptable to NATO, which includes the British and the Americans, for them to win elections. So they went round bombing, shooting and killing hundreds of Italians. And British intelligence services were deeply involved in all of this. Imposimato has written a book, Fernando Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, came out in 2012. So this is the head of the Italian Supreme Court pointing the finger at NATO intelligence services for carrying out all the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. And that means the British intelligence services. That means people who've got their kids in private schools in Britain were involved in all that terrorism.
Well, that's Italy, but what about Britain? I mean, he's talking about networks of people who are senior military officers, senior police, the media, various others in top levels of society, basically meeting behind the scenes. And it seems they have got actually much more sway over the executive, the cabinet in Italy, than the parliament does, our elected representatives. What about that in Britain?
Well, in Britain, we've got Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who ran the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland, which, according to Metropolitan Police investigation by Sir John Stevens, were largely responsible for the Loyalist paramilitary campaign in Northern Ireland, which killed hundreds of British citizens. So there we are. That's how it worked in Britain. But of course, it's not the Britain is a senior player in the Gladio networks, and British intelligence is a senior player within those networks. And so, of course, we've got things like the 7/7 bombings. Harun Ashwat is being extradited to the United States.
Oh, he has been extradited. Yeah, well, yeah, he's over there now.
Very interesting, because, of course, he was named by Brian Paddick when he was in charge of the investigation into 7/7 as a potential mastermind for the bombings, because he'd been on the phone to all four of the alleged bombers the week before.
Well, he was
attacks.
Also named by John Loftus, who's a senior prosecutor for the FBI under Jimmy Carter, as the mastermind. He was saying, actually, he was a mastermind. He was working for MI6, and there's a lot of
right.
things to potentially believe.
So, in other words, the potential is that
because
the
he was working. Martin, just a yeah. second, please. He was working very closely with Abu Hamza at Finsbury Park Mosque, and the ordinary Muslims in the mosque were reporting in the run-up to 7/7, saying, "Well, these guys in the mosque, we don't really want them around. They keep talking." About things which we don't think are Islamic. They seem to be extremists, and yet the police did nothing about it in the run-up to the 7/7 bombings and the security services. But the implication here is that the police, possibly the Met, would have liked to have acted, but they were being lent on from higher up.
Well, yes, and in actual fact, Harun Aswat probably was the mastermind, although there are questions about how the bombings were actually carried out. But the point is, if you know that Western intelligence services, including the British intelligence services, were running the Loyalist paramilitary campaign in Northern Ireland, killed hundreds of people in Italy in the 70s and 80s, and also in Germany, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre, in Belgium, the Brabant massacres in the supermarkets, is it possible that the Islamist threat is being manipulated, including the 7/7 bombings, which killed 50-some-odd people, the Bologna bombing in 1980 killed 80-some-odd people. That was definitely carried out by Western Intelligence Services. Was the London bombings carried out by Western Intelligence Services? There's got to be a suspicion that that's exactly what was going on.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Oh, there was also a documentary. It wasn't Panorama, I'm afraid. They don't do things like that anymore. On Russia Today this week, about the downing of flight MH17, the Malaysian airliner that killed 300 people downed in the east of Ukraine. Now, Martin, a couple of things they pointed out in the documentary, which were firstly that somebody had edited the Wikipedia page about the aircraft that apparently may have been in the vicinity at the time. That's the Sukhoi Su-25 of the Ukrainian Air Force. And also they pointed out some very interesting, I thought, very basic facts. That is to do with the Buk missile, which the West has said was used to shoot it down. First of all, we've heard that it is quite possible that there were certainly no Buk missiles in the hands of the Eastern Ukrainian separatists, that they were actually in the hands of the Ukrainian army, not the separatists. And so, which is a bit strange. They managed to get hold of one and then it's sort of disappeared. But the most important thing from my point of view was it showed that this missile, if it was fired, leaves an enormous great plume behind it, which hangs around in the air for 10 minutes, and yet nobody saw this.
Well, yes, and of course the BND, the German intelligence services, made a statement this week saying that they were convinced that it was shot down by a missile by the separatists. But let's come back to our previous item. Reinhard Gehlen was the head of the BND in the 1950s and 1960s, and he also happened to be the head of Gestapo Eastern Europe for Hitler. So when the BND says that they think that such and such happened, we've got to remember that this is effectively a Nazi NATO outfit, and these people tell lies. They just do.
What about the editing a Wikipedia page? That's a bit suspicious. A few weeks before the attack, apparently, according to this documentary, it showed the previous tracking for this Wikipedia page. Just a few weeks before, someone had come in and said that actually the maximum altitude of this fighter was actually lower than the plane was flying, and to make it look as if the plane couldn't possibly have been in the same bit of airspace at the same time.
Well, that's because the war is conducted with bullets and bombs, and it's also conducted on social media. The fact is the plane had been redirected by air traffic control in Kiev over the war zone. Why did that happen? We've got BBC Russia had their reporters on the ground, and they interviewed locals, all of whom said that they'd seen the plane shot down by Ukrainian aircraft, and that went up on the BBC's website in Moscow and then was taken down. What motive possibly would the Russian rebels have for shooting down an aircraft? Nobody knows. Why would they do it? It might have been an accident, but they've certainly got no motive. And of course, the shootings on the Maidan Square at the beginning, the telephone intercept between Umas Pirts and Catherine Ashton, definitely pointed the finger at Pravi Sector for killing both protesters and police. Again, that would fit the pattern of Gladio-style false flag terrorism. NATO intelligence services have got a documented track record of false flag terrorism, as pointed out by the head of the Italian Supreme Court. And in actual fact, therefore, we are entitled to say, for example, what happened in Canada this week, where the soldiers were killed and two so-called ISIS terrorist converts were shot dead in mysterious circumstances. Could that be a game by the NATO intelligence services? And the answer to that has to be definitely yes. It might not be, but it's a 90% chance that it is.
That's a pretty strong accusation. What evidence have you seen so far that might be the case then?
Because it fits the pattern of all the other provocations that we have seen.
Well, what specific things to do with that?
Specifically, the Canadians are voting on whether they should participate in the new in Iraq War 3.
All right, so you're saying the timing is actually
an indicator. The timing is incredibly suspicious. And these guys are, both of them have their passports taken away because they were thought to be a danger and that they might go to Syria, although both of them are actually converts to Islam, like many of these Patsy terrorists. And when we know that that Haroon Aswat was working for MI6 and all the rest of it, and what we know about Gladio from the historical investigations by the Italian police force, for example, the idea that people like MI6 and CIA go around carrying out terrorist attacks in order to achieve certain geopolitical goals, I'm afraid that is just absolutely, it's just absolutely the case. It may in individual cases be not the case. There are individual nutcases out there, but the pattern of NATO misbehaviour by the intelligence service is overwhelming, according to the Italian police. And the answer to all of this, of course, is to start the arrests. Start the arrests and let's unravel the whole structure. But it's been there for a long time and a lot of people are going to have to be arrested.
but it's sort of got to be done.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Finally tonight, it's 10 years since the ambassador for Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, was forced to resign. He was sacked. His website, craigmurray.org.uk, is a glorious blog, one of the best, I think, out there, political blogs, and it shows you, in a way, by looking at it, just what we're missing in much of the mainstream press. It's 10 years, he said, since I ended my Foreign Office career by going on the Today programme and blowing the whistle on CIA, MI6 complicity in torture. It was my 46th birthday, and I was in my second year as ambassador, and my 7th as a top Whitehall civil servant, member of the senior civil service. Looking back now, what's most striking are the blatant lies by the Foreign Commonwealth Office that they were not obtaining intelligence from torture. As the BBC reported, in one he claimed MI6 had used information passed on to it by the CIA, but originally obtained in Uzbek torture cells, something strongly denied by the Foreign Office. Martin, now, since Craig's whistleblowing, and he was a large part of it, actually exposing this whole network of secret prisons and extraordinary rendition.
Yes, another aspect of the shockingly illegal activities of our so-called intelligence services, who, far from protecting us from terror, are in many cases the perpetrators.
But we're also now in the situation where that doesn't seem to be happening so much. What seems to be happening now is drone wars and drones being used to kill people, because that's a little bit more swift and convenient. Now, whereabouts are we heading with this? Because this is a pretty nasty stuff in international law, obviously completely illegal.
Well, I mean, all of the stuff that's going on is illegal, and I think the answer ultimately has to be to enforce the law, which is why Imposimato comes in as the head of the Italian Supreme Court. His book is based upon decades of investigation by the civilian Italian police force, and the civilian police force need to get their skates on and start arresting some of these military intelligence people. Thanks. That's the way to put a stop to terrorism.
Thanks, Martin. Time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, editor of Bristol247.com, Chris Brown. You can follow my Twitter feed in between shows at Tony Gosling. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And don't let those banksters get you down.
National news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. David Cameron says the EU's demand for an extra £1.7 billion from UK taxpayers is unacceptable and unjustified. A visibly furious Prime Minister has flatly refused to pay the money by the deadline of December the 1st. The bill's due because the UK's economy has improved more than officials were predicting. But Mr Cameron says it's not on.
We do have these changes where they look at how economies have grown, and sometimes you have to pay a little bit more, sometimes you pay a little bit less. But it's never happened like this before, a €2 billion bill, and that is not acceptable.
Asda is facing a huge legal battle involving thousands of female employees who say they're underpaid compared to male colleagues. A legal firm says it's been approached by more than 19,000 people. It's claimed that women working in stores are being paid less than men working in the company's distribution centres. Asda says it doesn't discriminate and will robustly defend itself. Our reporter Emma Birchley is at a store in Ipswich.
These women who are taking the action are saying that actually the jobs they do are of equal value. It involves unpacking pallets on one side, packing them on the other side, putting things onto shelves. They're doing a pretty similar job, but in different locations.
Firefighters in England are to strike from October the 31st in their continuing row with the government over pensions. The Fire Brigades Union says members will walk up for 4 days from 6 p.m, ending on the evening before bonfire night. Two American nurses, Nina Pham and Amber Vinson, have been declared cured of Ebola. The women contracted the disease while caring for a Liberian patient in Texas who died on the 8th of October. In a world-first operation, doctors in Australia have managed to transplant a heart that had stopped beating. The breakthrough technique was carried out by surgeons at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. And Little Britain star Matt Lucas will host the International Emmy Awards in New York next month. Nominees include Olivia Colman in Broadchurch and the drama series Utopia. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
BCFM 93.2 is your triple award-winning radio station, and it's not surprising that we're attracting more new listeners than any other radio station in the city.